Welcome to the second now annual, we can say for sure, you only need two to make it annual, the second annual Read and Feed Festival of Literature and Food. Hunched over before you, I'm Jeffrey Lappendorf, the Executive Director of CLMP, the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses. Starting this month, we begin our 50th year, which is amazing. And no applause, 50 years. 50 years of covering for all publishers. Thank you. We were listed for publishing. We were started by George Clint and Russell Vance, Clayton Eshelman, and a bunch of others 50 years ago. Folks who understood that sometimes the smallest publishers do the biggest job of getting literature from great writers to wonderful readers like all of you. We are so thrilled this year to be celebrating the just about 90th birthday of Hudson's own John Ashbery. I can say easily my favorite poet, I know, of our panel. We have quite a panel of poetry luminaries here who are going to share why and how they love reading John Ashbery. And I'm now going to introduce our moderator, and he will introduce them so that I can return to my presentation. Robert Pulido, our moderator, has too many credits for me to read and read any time for the panel, so I'll just pick a couple. He has been head of the Poetry Foundation. He has served as director of the Creative Writing Program at the New School. He has written and edited so many books. I'll just give a couple. Savage Arbor Biography of Jim Thompson was a National Book Critics Circle Award. I should say that Robert himself is a quite excellent poet with many poetry credits to his name as well. And I'm not going to list all of them, but I'll say that if you ever need advice on a noir film, watch, he's your guy. Robert is something I thought that we must have everyone know. It really is just an amazing individual. I'm so happy to hear Robert, and I'm going to let you take a look.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Can everyone hear? Yes, this is working. So it's my pleasure also to welcome you to John Ashbery Week here in Hudson, and this ongoing celebration of John's extraordinary work as a poet, essayist, and art critic. And also, as Jeffrey mentioned, the fact that this coming Friday he turns 90 years of age. And I wonder if we should maybe applaud John and hope that he hears us as well. So Jeffrey asked me very briefly to introduce the extraordinary panel that we have here, more or less limiting me to one sentence per person. And if I run on, I think I might be able to do it, but this is an extraordinary panel. So Daryl Weyer is next to me. She's a poet, an editor, and a teacher. And her most recent books include You Good Thing, her selected poems, and coming out this October, In the Still of the Night. Joan Redilak is next to her. She's a poet, critic, biographer, and teacher. And she's written about John Cage and Gertrude Stein, among many others. And her recent books include Procedural Elegies and The Poetical Wager. And then Anne Lauterbach, poet, essayist, teacher, and MacArthur Fellow. And among her most recent books are Under the Sign, Or to Begin Again, and The Night Sky. So please welcome our panel. An unusual moment and an unusual subject, because it's 2017, John's about to turn 90, and I sort of feel I've been hearing all of my life this conversation about how to read John Ashbery. Like, it really as far back as when I was an undergraduate at Boston College in the 1970s, and I think that the implication is clearly that reading John Ashbery seems to be different from reading other books. And maybe John Ashbery is more elusive, perhaps even more difficult than other writers. And there's a kind of persistent strangeness about the work. And I wonder if we might, since so many of John's poems are about writing poems, and I'm going to read one in a minute that does that, but I wonder if we might kind of start there with in a kind of meta way about the title of the panel and the issues that the panel implies and raises. And anyone can jump in.
Can you formulate that as a kind of a question?
Why do you think 50 years on, we're still asking the question about how we're being judged?
We're, of course, still asking that question about John Cage's work, about Gertrude Stein, to name the most obvious poets, composers of language. And I think there is a very similar answer for all three of those, even though their work is so different. And it has to do with worrying about the meaning behind the language, rather than savoring the language, and allowing it to activate one's own reading poesis. And I think the poesis, the making of form in language that the poet activates and by composing, is only one half of the presence of a poem, the experience of the poem. The other half is the reading poesis. It's what the reader is able to make of it. And those two things combined are the realization, as I say in music, of the poem. People, I think, have been misled by a lot of academic training and leftover training that has to do more with symbolism and even early modernism than with what is going on in a more contemporary postmodern field. And I think there are examples of that. I would love to. I mean, John is writing about that.
Did you want to read something? I'd like to read something.
Yeah.
Too,
yeah.
Maybe well, I'll read something.
Right. So, in preparing for this, the pleasure of preparing for this, I went to three poems, which is a 1977 book. That begins with a long poem, it's three long poems, called The New Spirit. And John is immediately talking about the question of poetics and his own poetics in a really interrogative way, although there aren't actually any question marks. So I'll just read that first page. I thought that if I could put it all down, that would be one way. And next the thought came to me that to leave all out would be another and truer way. And there's a lot of space, so he's leaving things out. And these sort of sapphic fragments, there are two of them. Clean washed sea. The flowers were. These are examples of leaving out, but forget as we will, something soon comes to stand in their place. Not the truth, perhaps, but yourself. It is you who made this, therefore you are true, but the truth has passed on. Space to divide all. So, I think I'll stop here. I want to actually read something later, while we're still on the subject, from Girls on the Run, that really is the other side of the bracket of that major question about poetics.
If I might, let me then read a poem that's in a very different style, called How to Continue from Hotel Rocamont. So we have other instances of his language in our ears. How to continue? Well, there once was a woman, and she kept a shop selling trinkets to tourists not far from a dock who came to see what life could be far back on the island. And it was always a party there, always different, but very nice. New friends to give you advice or fall in love with you, which is nice. And each grew so perfectly from the other, it was a marvel of poetry and irony. And in this unsafe quarter, much was scary and dirty. But no one seemed to mind then. The parties went on from house to house. There were friends and lovers of war all around the sport. There was moonshine in winter and starshine in summer, and everybody was happy to have discovered what they discovered. And then one day the ship sailed away. There were no more dreamers, just sleepers, in heavy attitudes on the dock, moving as if they knew how. Among the trinkets and souvenirs, the random shops of modern furniture, and a gale came and said, it is time to take all of you away, from the tops of the trees to the little houses on the little paths so far. And when it became time to go, they none of them would leave without the other. For they said, we are all one of you, and if one of us goes, the other will not go. And the wind whispered it to the stars. The people all got up to go and looked back on love. It's a very different kind of poem from three poems. But I wonder if we could hear from the others before I say anything about that.
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of poems in Ashbury, but the voice is always constant. So there's a kind of a continuum of, and for me, I'm always trying to locate what that voice is and how it makes possible what it makes possible. And I think what happens with him is that you begin with a kind of understanding because of the syntax that he's going to be making a kind of sense. The syntax is so strong. And then he baffles you inside of that profound understanding of the relation of subjects and objects and so on that happens inside of each of the poems. And so the bafflement becomes this kind of extension or opening. If you're lucky, you don't go away and say, I don't understand this. You say, there's some kind of sense being made, but it's a different kind of sense than I expected. And the result of that, once you fall in love, is that you realize that the foiling of expectation is a way of enlarging our sense of the possible. And I'm reminded that John called Stein's work a hint of a possibility, a hint to possibility. And of course, I think that John's work was a hint to possibility. And there are ways in which you can talk about exactly how this is accomplished. And I think it is to do with the modality of this wonderfully alert and variable syntax, and married to a kind of extraordinary diction or vocabulary, which is filled with unexpected words, almost invariably. And the adjective that goes with the noun is not the expected adjective with the noun. And this kind of variability inside of the making of the poem is what, well, for some of us anyway, becomes this opening, this adventure, kind of adventure.
I wonder if we all agree that the voice is the constant in these poems, or whether the voice changes over time from book to book. And I guess it probably depends on what we mean by voice.
But you know, there is that great thing that I think it's Angus Fletcher who talks about the middle voice, and which is in Greek rhetoric, where the subject is both passive and active at the same time. And I think this idea of the middle is the informing voice, the tonal space, because intensities don't really happen in the middle, but in the middle, it's the middle that allows for many different kinds of things to happen at the same time.
So I think from one point of view, you could argue that the voice of three poems was totally different from the voice of How to Continue. You know, that voice is, in a way, the voice of How to Continue is much more available to
think it's important, though, to also realize that as time goes on, John is listening to other voices. He's collecting other voices, and they actually collecting statements and so on. And what he's doing, that's apart from selecting with his particular poetic form of attention, is composing those collected units of language. And so I think it becomes a matter, with some of his work, particularly his more recent work in the last couple of decades, more a matter of composition than voice.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if maybe part of the issue about why we're here still talking about this question 50 years later has to do with John is such a capacious poet and changes so much from book to book, is that we're much more used to poets who operate upon along a much more narrow continuum. And if they enlarge or deepen, it's usually within a kind of structure that they've already set up. And they teach us how to read their work as they go along. And I think John teaches us how to read his work, but it's often from book to book. He teaches you how to read the poems in that book, which isn't necessarily useful for the next book that he's going to write. Yeah?
I'm usually nervous enough when I do anything like this that I tend to write something down. So I hope you forgive me if I read to you just a little bit. I'm going to begin by filtering my voice in response to the question, how do you read Giant Fairy? By reading a poem by Marianne Moore, who I know is someone who John had great affection for. And this is her poem is called When I Buy Pictures. And it's going to be changed to be called When I Read John Ashbery. Or what is closer to the truth, when I look at that of which I may regard myself in the imaginary presence, I fix upon what would give me pleasure in my average moments. The satire upon curiosity, in which no one is more discernible than the intensity of moods, or quite the opposite, the old thing, the medieval decorated hat box, in which there are hounds with waist diminishing like the waist of the hourglass, and deer, and birds, and seated people. It may be no more than a square of parquetry, the literal biography, perhaps, in letters standing well apart upon a parchment-like expanse. An artichoke in six varieties of blue, the snipe-legged hieroglyphic in three parts, the silver fence protecting Adam's grave, or Michael taking Adam by the wrist. Too stern an intellectual emphasis upon this quality or that detracts from one's enjoyment. It must not wish to disarm anything, nor may the approved triumph easily be honored. That which is great because something else is small. It comes to this of whatever sort it is. It must be lit with piercing glances into the life of things. It must acknowledge the spiritual forces which have made it. And I feel like that poem speaks so clearly to why I love reading John when I read him, that I was grateful that I stumbled upon this poem of Marianne Moore's to summarize a whole lot of the powerful things that I experienced. I've always loved childish things like Russian dolls or anything that fits inside of anything else. And the Morton Salt Girl on her salt box, for instance. Anything that is something within something within something. I like a frame on a picture. I like a picture in a picture. I like goods. I like those time-lapse photography films. I like stop action action. I used to not like poems about poems. speaking to what you're talking about. These made me very nervous for a while, and then one day, in an antique store in Deerfield, Massachusetts, I came upon something that dropped that particular veil from my eyes. I was walking in the door, and my eyes directly were directed to a piece of calligraphy. I walked closer, I looked more, and never had calligraphy before been anything I have thought too much about. And with all due respect to calligraphers, I saw there something I'd never seen before. Layers and layers of something written, grafted, laid on a page, words that were drawing me in by their design like a vortex, like a real reverie. And when I got close enough to see what finally, or perhaps firstly, who knows which way this was made, one can't know, and what I saw under the spell was the final layer within this giant calligraphic tour de force. And it said, executed with a pen. And the veil dropped from my eyes, and I was so relieved to not be prejudiced anymore about that particular aspect of reading, because I was shy about it, and I was missing a lot of great things. So I'll stop there. I have a few more things I want to say.
But that was a very Antiquarian response to the question. I mean, in so many ways, including the way it kind of grew on multiple lives, kind of simultaneously. And I wonder if another part of the reason why we're here is, you know, when you're lucky enough to have John as a friend, I mean, every time you see him, he has a new novel to recommend, a new movie to recommend, a new poet, a new painting to recommend. And there's a sense of John, you know, kind of deeply engaged with the culture of the last 100 years. And I wonder if this sophomore or one would want to kind of address the importance of other arts for the experience of reading John's work.
I might say quite simply that it occurred to me when I was thinking about this poem that he actually manages throughout the work to make the temporal and the spatial simultaneous, which is really extraordinary if you think about how language works, which is linear. But in fact, as you move along, you think simultaneously of how music works, which is, I often think, he's braiding together a number of narratives in the same narrative, which is really part of what we were saying, which is what music does. And then the other thing is that because of this, what I take to be not the foreground and not the background, but this large middle ground, I think about paintings which have large middle grounds, and in the large middle ground, lots of different kinds of things are possible, but nothing is in total focus, so there's no detail that jumps out from another detail, and that, I think...
Kind of democracy.
Well, it's a form of democracy. Yeah. There's ethics under this that's very powerful,
right.
And it is about a kind of one variety of this profound emission of high low, for example, which he partly inherited, but he's in the generation that really decided just not to have that high country low culture. So he took that up really brilliantly. So when you go to his house and you see the things that he loves, they are in all of those categories, high, low, and whatever the middle might be. So I think there's again, this understanding that a poem is as capacious as the world, the world, life. And that brings us back to, he brings the news in a kind of interesting way, you know. And the news, and I want to tie that to information, because for some reason or other, I don't know how he does it, but he knows so much, but the knowledge that he has, that is to say information, which is never in the foreground, it's always dissolved it's the underpinning of the world.
It's a subterranean foundation.
So you never feel like, oh, I don't know that, or I don't know that. It never makes you feel embarrassed by your ignorance. it's with a kind of generosity.
I've introduced John to a lot of younger readers in my lifetime as a teacher. And there are a couple of outstanding anecdotes that I remember from their experiences with meeting him newly. One of them was a series of weeks in which we started reading John's work from the beginning, because I tend to like to start there with people, and kept going. And after about three or four books, one of the graduate students in the class took me aside before it started, and she said, "I know this is really embarrassing to say, but whenever I read John Ashbery, I think he's written it just for me." And that sense of the intimacy that John allows to happen, that's related to what you're saying about not making you feel like you don't know something, is part of the entrance in which you're invited to come and share in that great curiosity that I think is the greatest privilege of reading him most of the time. I have another graduate student who is right now working on a project called Wolf Trap. And it started because she had been teaching John's great book, Flowchart, for 15 years at Landmark College, which is a college in particularly designed for dyslexic or ADHD, kids who have a really hard time in traditional colleges. And she always, for 15 years, introduced a year-long poetry class by having them read Flowchart. And it really worked. And it was a beautiful thing. So she retired about a year ago, and she's not teaching it. So she started this project where she would write down the first sentence of Flowchart, and then write whatever that got her to write. And she did that for a while, and then realized she could do it word by word. So for the last 8 months now, she has been taking apart the pieces of Flowchart, and not necessarily writing about it, explaining, nothing like that, just living in it with her own words, either in conversation or just juxtaposed to it. And I think that's a kind of beautiful invitation.
Plus, it's such a long poem.
Exactly. Well, she needed that. She needed that.
Generation.
No.
And I happen to have Dara, if you don't mind, just putting this in. I have the first 6 lines of Flowchart in front of me. So I'll give that so that we can hear that. Overtaken by a new form of despair, I ask the diagram, is this the foretaste of pain in my PCD? Or an emptiness so sudden that it leaves birds whining in the absence of wind, the sky milk blue and astringent. So that word whining, is it whining or is it whining? I don't quite know. He does that all the time. He makes you go and you look up and how is this pronounced? And I just want to point out that the nouns in those 6 lines are city, form, despair, diagram, foretaste, pain, emptiness, and birds, absence, wind, and sky. So they're very familiar nouns, and somehow he takes these familiar nouns. Almost always some kind of piece of weather is involved. I think that's one of the baselines of Ashbery's understanding of the day. Is always there as a kind of weather. But then you take these many nouns and you recombine them so the idea of the city or form or despair or diagram or foretaste or pain or emptiness or birds or acids or wind or sky is oddly altered.
Again, the new spirit that has to do with skies as well. And with the, you know, the memory of these juicy words that are in what Anne just read, like langing and astringent.
Yes.
So here is John worrying in 1977, or probably before 1977, about a poetics that is reaching with its metaphor toward the sky. And I'm just going to read a fragment. I hope it's enough. In the other direction, one saw a desert, and drooping above it, the constellations that had presided impassively over the building of the metaphor. We're going to read that one more time. The desert, drooping above it, the constellations that had presided impassively over the building of the metaphor. And then it goes on, the metaphor, I'm repeating it, he doesn't, that seemed about to erase them from the skies. So, is that clear? Should I read the whole thing through? Or did you? It's the concern, actually Jeffrey's saying yes, read it all the way through. So, but I'll just say that his concern about what is a, has been a very big concern from at least modernism on, that there was, say, in the 19th century, a tendency to replace the actual being, the experience, the presence, with the metaphor, with the symbol of it. And he's worried about that here, because he, I mean, so far up to this time and beyond, he's partly, I mean, this is partly his heritage, to do magical things with metaphors. He never gives them up, but he does something very different with them later. So again, I'll read that. In the other direction, one saw the desert and drooping above it, the constellations that had presided impassively over the building of the metaphor that seemed about to erase them, the constellations, from the skies. So I just to a comment, I think there John is acknowledging the inherent antagonism between constellations, actual constellations in the skies, and metaphors about them, that they actually simultaneously drain energy from each other, and so then the puzzle becomes: what do you do about that? The reign of the metaphor has, in a sense, yielded to a friendly competition between birds and things.
Yes.
I mean, the references never go, but they become more embodied in the words, the sensuality of the language.
The train sounds good.
Yeah. It is a train.
Yeah. My words were in friendly competition.
I know, you were, yeah. I have one more little pieces to read, but one more story about a student, or actually a whole class, was reading flowchart with me, and I paired it with reading Emil Cioran, a Romanian turned Parisian philosopher of the bitterest kind, and they were reading a book called The Trouble with Being Born, which probably tells you everything you need to know about it. And it worked beautifully because they would all rush to read John after reading Chiron. And so I didn't know that was going to happen. It was not a plot. But it dawned on me after it was happening for a while, so I loved it. When I read John Ashbery, I find myself, I can only pretend to say anything John's poems in person and presence don't already say. I did realize that a few of the many things I'm reminded of concerning his infinitely generous values are his open-minded, open-hearted acceptance of and interest in new poets and new poetry. He actually likes new poets and young poets, and every kind of new poetry is of interest to him. It's maybe not completely rare, but it's rare enough to find someone who appreciates that. He's helped along young poets as diverse and across the spectrum as conceptually inclined to the character-driven location dwellers. It takes curiosity and an open heart to learn to love new poets of vastly different inclinations. He showed us that deeply in his beautiful other traditions. I thought I loved John Clare. He introduced me to another John Clare. I thought I knew Laura Riding. He introduced me to another Laura Riding. This must be how finding an other by means of another works. I'll stop.
My little comment was the helps is that cute. The other worlds.
Yeah.
But I think what we're hearing is like how important John's example has been to all of us, and I know that many of the poets in this room about how you keep your own heart alive. And I wonder if people would either want to talk about that aspect of the question, or maybe another aspect, which would be the way that their experience of reading Ashbery has changed over the decades that we've all been doing that. You can approach it personally or from the
community. So I think it's my privilege to say probably all three of us here, I've known John longest because I invited him to London in 1972, David, was it? 71? Somewhere around. To read. And he had, in fact, just finished writing this book, Three Poems, and I was very ignorant, but there were people in London at the time who were not, and so the consensus was that the American poet who should come to London should be John Ashbery. The other contender was Gary Snyder, so you can see that we were in a kind of interesting shift space. Understood that a poem was a pretty neat well-made object, and it should be concise and small. But my own sensibility was neither concise nor small. It's exactly what my mental space was, nothing but kind of messy and extending. I loved Henry James, for example. So this poem, these poems that came, I really didn't know what to do with it at all, other than the fact that there was suddenly this capaciousness that was open right in front of me, like walking into a landscape. You know, you have been in this little room, and you walk through the door, and you're like, oh my God, look. And then I had this astonishing understanding that a poem had anything in it that it needed. And that was the key to a permission granted. So for me, that is the initial personal understanding of the of you. You can walk through that small, from that little room of the poem into this world. Actually, it's wilderness that he offered. And my gratitude is unending, as in fact is in my love.
I've learned so much from reading John's work from the first encounter I had with it. First thing I learned was patience. To wait to see what happens and to not get ahead of a poem and let the poem come to me. And I think that was a wonderful thing to have happen to me. And that kind of gives you courage as a reader, I think, which I think is another really beautiful thing to have happen. I've never been disappointed, which is also a great gift to get from reading somebody, I think. And the differences you're talking about in his composition manners and his subject matters are, what do they do except give you the world? You know, and that's what you want when you read a poem for the most thing, I think. So I'd say that's all I'd say.
I'd like to respond as a teacher, because my reading of actually anyone has been enormously affected by the way I read when I'm going to present things to students, whether it's in a seminar or a workshop of some sort. And one of the things that I found was that in wanting to present students always with difficulty, I feel if students are not facing some sort of difficulty because they haven't seen this before, haven't known what to do with it, why are you there in a pedagogical setting? A poem that was particularly important in that respect, actually, one is Girls on the Run, which is going to be, a lot of you here are part of the collaborative reading that's going to happen right after this. This is an extraordinary sort of continuation of the project of Henry Darger. That is a queer project and an extraordinarily wholesome project at one and the same time. It has to do with the world of childhood that is both a sort of technicolor paradise, or I should say, is a technicolor paradise if you enjoy being a child, with a noir subtext, and is the case, I think, for most children, and today, particularly so, if you look at what's going on in the globe. But the other thing is that in teaching, I tended to choose poetry that I wanted to know more about, to discover more about, that I was curious about. And one of those poems, I'm sure many of you know, is Last Night I Dreamed I Was in Bucharest, which I actually took to a teaching situation in Palestine, in a university there on the West Bank called Al-Quds, in work that I was doing with bilingual faculty there. And it became a major extended moment in the work we were doing together, having to do with how very different people with very different backgrounds and languages can come together over the pleasures and the challenges of making meaning of a poem. So I just actually want to read a little bit of that. Is there time for me to
just
okay, so it begins, last night I dreamed I was in Bucharest, seeking to convince the supreme jester that I am indeed the man in those commercials. Simultaneously, it peaked in Bolivia, the moon, I mean. Then we were walking over what seemed to be heather, or was called that. The downtown riot of free speech occurred, plastered to its muzzle, Randy, the dog's decoding apparatus went astray, etc. So just from that bit, he's still working on the question of language in relation to events and things. Later he says, the lawn was closer to a farm, this time the lawn mouthed farm. So it brought up so many layers to play with, and the way we worked on it was by reading it aloud. So I think I just want to say that I think the most important thing about Ashbery, as with Stein, is to read it aloud, and particularly reading work aloud in collaboration, where there's a playful but a purposeful playfulness in becoming more intimate with what is happening.
And my own experience in teaching Ashbery, I think, intersects that, because I think my students have a lot less trouble with Ashbery than my teachers. And if you grew up on a kind of a epiphany driven poem,
that's totally true.
You know, he's always like skirting and eluding that and escaping that. And the world that my students live inside, like on the internet, like the collages and collisions of language on the internet, is a lot like, in fact, my classic.
Yeah.
And a lot of the popular music my students listen to echoes that, parallels that. I mean, when you were talking about syntax and the illusion of meaning, I mean, that's Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, too, you know? It's perfect syntax, but it's something
I think
else.
It's implicit in everything you said, but I think maybe we should bring forward the kind of meaningness of the experience of reading, which is something about how the conversion of bafflement into pleasure, which is orchestrated through what you really have to think of as a kind of powerful, profound humor. I mean, really, not a light humor, not a comedic humor, but a humor that is really about the amusement of life. I mean, he is endlessly amused. And because he's endlessly amused in the sense of paying attention and thinking about all the ways in which one is amused in the deepest sense, then that's conveyed over to us as a form of
humor always laced with gravitas, and gravitas always laced with humor.
I think Jeffrey is insisting that we stop, but I wonder if anyone has has something they would like to say to John on his 90th birthday? You could just run down the row.
Aww. I love you, John.
You know I love you, John.
Oh, you make me feel so young.
Well, thank you very much.
Love you.